Welcome back, comedy fans, to an all-new comedy at the Carlson Cast. Get your information at carlsoncast.com. Today's episode, our special guest is Mr. Mark Normand, everybody. And now his people have been hard at work putting a tarp over anything associated with Brian Ball. It's Mr. Vinny Paulino.
Hello, everybody. Woo. Welcome to another Carlson Cast. I liked that intro.
Thank you.
It's true. It's very true.
I put a tarp over Brian.
You've been burying me all morning.
I know. I don't know what it is.
It's been vicious.
It's just your
really?
Face.
Yeah. No. No. Ross. He's got his sassy pants on today.
I think it's your face. It just inspires me.
Yeah.
God, it's like a cafeteria. It's your face. Some good stuff there, Ross.
Thank you.
Yeah. But his face is infuriating.
I mean, it is kind of infuriating.
Yeah.
It's the Carlson Cast. We have a big show, as you heard. Our guest today is a critically acclaimed comedian and. Trust me, going to be a household name in comedy in America for a very, very long time. And the guy is only like 30-something. It's Mark Normand, guys. Mark Norman's here.
Woo!
I'm very interested to talk to him. He's an amazing joke writer. He's done Conan O'Brien 6 times.
Seven. Seven. Yeah, he told me last night. Yeah, 7 times.
7 times.
Yeah.
Lucky number 7.
Yeah.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
Seven appearances on any late night show is pretty good. That's like Burt Reynolds was on The Tonight Show 7 times.
Yeah.
Like
this. Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
And
so,
he's been on The Tonight Show too. So
Tonight Show, Stephen Colbert. We're going to get into all that stuff with him in just a little bit. Brian Ball is my co-host. I'm sorry about that. He's still here. Today, though, I have to give you all a quick reminder before we delve into our interview. We have the Funniest Person Rochester contest coming up pretty soon. I'm going to have you hit my computer in just a second there, Cam. I will have you hit my computer in just a second. The Funniest Person Rochester contest is happening here at Comedy at the Carlson this summer, and we would like you to be a part of it. Go ahead and hit it now. There you go. So basically, what's going to be happening is we are inviting anyone who thinks they're funny to come and give comedy a shot here on our big stage. This is a big deal. We don't generally just let people come on into the club and step up on the stage and perform. But this is your opportunity to do just that. Even for new comic night, we usually have it in the Rickles room. And there's a 20-person limit.
Mm-hmm.
This is your shot to basically audition for the club. We have a $1,000 cash prize we're going to be giving away, and we will declare a funniest person in Rochester. Last year, our winner, Cindy Arena, was doing comedy, and I talked to her this week and confirmed this for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, she'd been on stage, I think she said 3 times before her opening round.
Now, if that shouldn't give you, like, some confidence to at least give it a shot, I don't know what else could. So the reason why we're bringing this up today is because tomorrow, June 1st, is the absolute last day to register. So register, get in there, and we will give you an email back this week and let you know which date you will be performing. We're looking in that first round for 3 to 4 minutes of comedy. 3 to 4 minutes of your own original material, please. And we'll put you forward into the next round if you make it. So
yeah, and hopefully some new blood in there, too, like you said. You know, that's kind of the neat thing about it.
We have already, because I'm in charge of like looking at the registrations, we have about 78 people signed up at the moment, and a good majority of them, I do not know their names, which, not that that means anything, but I wouldn't generally know your name if you've been doing comedy in the city for a while. So there's a lot of new people coming in. This is not a contest for ringers. I'm not allowing ringers into the contest. Semi-pros not doing it, you know.
Well, and like Bob Newhart was an accountant who like told some jokes to a friend of a friend who knew a guy,
right?
And got like an album contract immediately, like before he'd ever even been on stage. So
that's not going to happen.
You might somebody might buy you a drink, but
that might happen.
But you could, you know, you don't have to be a pro.
That is absolutely correct. And I couldn't have said any better.
Sign-ups end tomorrow, right? No, I didn't know.
Yeah, they
I didn't
do, Brian. Thank
not.
You.
I didn't know if you said it or not.
It's not just his face.
What show are you on?
What did I
do? Do you know what show?
What did I do now? Here, I didn't hear you say it. I was thinking about Werther's.
If you're not paying attention, I don't know how anybody else can be expected to.
Brian Stroke, brought to you by the Funniest Person in Rochester Contest 2019. Yeah. Brian, tomorrow is the last day to register.
Okay, good. Good. Thanks for clearing that up for me.
Yeah, no problem. It's also currently 8:54 a.m. Okay. Almost time for your medicine. We're going to be back with Mark Norman in just a minute, so stay tuned, everybody. We're going to tell you a little bit about the shows that are coming up here at Comedy at the Carlson. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to another Comedy at the Carlson cast. We've got big shows coming up starting next week here at Comedy at the Carlson. We have Mark Norman, May 30th through June 1st, followed up by Mr. Dan Soder, June 6th through the 8th. Guy Sands will be here one night only in the Rickles Room, June 8th. Jim Florentine returns, June 13th through the 15th. Jamie Lissau also returns, June 20th through the 22nd. Nicole Byer making her Comedy at the Carlson debut, July 11th through July 13th. Mike Dammer will be here July 18th through the 20th. Pat McGann, July 25th through the 27th. Chris Jones, one night only, July 27th in the Rickles Room. Bobby Collins, comedy legend, August 2nd and 3rd. Thea Vidal, August 15th through the 17th. And isn't this a nice surprise? Ron Funches will be here September 5th through the 7th. Harlan Williams will be showing up September 12th through the 14th. And Tim Meadows, SNL alum, September 19th through the 21st. And our good friend Vicky Barbalak will be back November 21st through the 23rd. Man, things are getting interesting going into the fall. We're in the spring. We're going to go through the summer. But, man, I'll tell you, we got a lot of awesome shows happening. So check out carlsoncomedy.com or call 585-4COMEDY for tickets. See you. Hey, everybody. We are back. We're live right now. Joining us in the studio, he's a critically acclaimed comedian. You've seen him on pretty much every late night show. You've seen him on Inside Amy Schumer. He's here in Rochester this weekend at Comedy at the Carlson. It's Mark Norman. Give it up for him, everybody.
That's all I get is Inside Amy Schumer. Come on, that show's not even on anymore.
Yeah.
Give me something. Tonight's okay. Show, hour special, Conan.
We were going to get to your hour special. That just dropped too, didn't it?
No, that's about 3 years old.
3 years old.
I'm
okay.
Sorry, I'm
this
a
is
cunt.
A good start. So, New Orleans.
Yeah, born and raised. Fun town. Lost my virginity to a prostitute on Bourbon Street.
As one does.
Yeah. Great town, fun city. Not a great place to grow up, if I can be honest.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Like, I read your bio on your website. Pretty basic research stuff here, but you said that your parents were very normal.
Yeah.
But like, I can't imagine like normal people living in New Orleans.
Right. Well, they're very they're like hardworking workaholic people who they're both lawyers, and they hated the kids. They didn't hate us, but they were busy.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I got kind of raised by we had a nanny lady, basically a trans woman. It's a lot. Boy, if you really want to get into it.
Yeah, do it. Tell me more.
All right, so my parents bought a mansion, like a dilapidated mansion in a poor black neighborhood because it was so cheap. And my dad always wanted to be this rich, big-time, big fish kind of guy. So he bought this mansion, but it was so expensive to keep it up, all the upkeep, that he had to make the back half of it into a bed and breakfast. So now he's got, like, Chinese businessmen and traveling musicians, you know, trying to stay there. This is like pre-Airbnb.
Right.
And so he had to hire, he would be working all the time, so he had to hire a housekeeper who was a black guy named Enos who wore a wig and high heels. He was like a burlesque guy at night. So he was like a trans person before trans. We'd call it a transvestite.
Yeah.
You know, just the outfit. But he still had the dong and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he like taught me how to, you know, go on a date and fight and do this and treat women and all that shit. Tough guy. So it was a weird upbringing, to say the least.
So we got robbed all the time.
So it sounds interesting.
That's a lot to unpack.
It was interesting.
So like how close were you with this guy? Was he just like
super close? We were buds. You know, really? I was 7 or 8 or 9. I was probably like, you know, 9, 10, 11. And he was maybe 35 and. We just hung out all day, like during the summers.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
Fun story, I got my bike stolen from me by these street toughs. And I'm riding down the street.
Hooligans.
Yeah, riffraffs. And I'm riding home, and these kind of, I was probably 10, 11, these 17, 18-year-old kids pull up, and they go, give me your bike. And, you know, these are big, scary black people. And I was like, I'm good. And they, like, you know, push me off. They take the bike. So I go home. I run home crying. And Enos goes, what happened? And I go, these kids stole my bike. And he goes, well, let's go get it. And I'm like, it's gone. It's gone. But he's like my male role model. My dad's working.
Yeah.
So
he put on his heels.
he was wearing heels.
Yeah.
He put on his lipstick, and we went out there, and he had this big van, and we're driving around the van. I'm like hunched down. I'm so nervous. I don't want to see these kids again.
Yeah.
I just want to be done with it. And these kids are sitting on a stoop, like taking my bike apart to kind of make it not look like mine, you know, as you do. And he goes, "Is that your bike?" I go, "That's it." I'm like slunched down. This guy's got a wig on, and he goes up to these kids. And these are like street kids, you know? So this is the 90s. He goes up and they're like, look at this fucking faggot. They're going nuts, you know? They're like, look at this homo. They're freaking out. Their words. And he just goes, that's not your bike. And they go, what are you going to do about it? I mean, this kid's holding a ratchet, you know? Like, yeah. These kids aren't going to, they're not messing around. And so he goes, I'm going to take that bike back. And they go, oh, yeah? And he goes, yeah. And he puts his hand on the bike. I fucks him. Nobody did anything, and he just pulls the bike toward him, puts it over his shoulder, turns around, walks to the van, slides the door open, throws the bike in, slides it back. We drive off.
Did he have a purse with a brick in it?
No purse. But wow. I think if you're a tranny in the 90s, you got to be pretty tough.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
So. Yeah, like in the South especially, just in general.
Totally.
So... did not know any of that. That is a story.
No, that's great. That's a great story.
That's an amazing story.
Just on morning radio, so I wasn't allowed to talk for 10 minutes. So it's nice to be able to talk again.
Talk all day, man. That's a crazy story. So like when you were a kid, you were into making movies, short films and stuff like that?
Yeah. All that stuff. I had a video camera and I was obsessed with stop motion animation, and me and my friends would stay up late and shoot movies and edit movies and all that. We were obsessed. I went to film school for 10 minutes in New York, and that's when I fell in love with New York. And I would do film school during the day, and then I would do open mics at night in New York. And I realized, oh, this is what I want to do. Movies are tough because it's so much collaboration. Yeah. You know, you got to get the actors together. You got to write the script, the lighting guy, the grip guy, the cameraman, the editing. It's so much to unpack with a movie. But with comedy, you go, I have a joke, I say it on stage.
Where's the stage? Where's the mic?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And you're done.
So you coming up in New Orleans, you were into filmmaking. Obviously, you said you went up to New York to pursue that.
Yeah.
At what point did stand-up come into the picture for you? Were you like a big stand-up fan growing up? Was it something you always wanted to do? How do you even get onto the stage for the first time?
Well, that's a good question. I went to college, and I lived in a house with five guys. We had beer pong and a hot tub. We were just trying to get laid and trying to drink. And I was such a loser. Like, our biggest thing was just, like, there was a place around our house, and I went to Baton Rouge, LSU College, and there was a store that they said, if you bring us three empty keg shells, we'll give you a full keg. And that was our whole life. So we just drive around stealing keg shells.
I was gonna say, that sounds like a challenge.
Yeah, because we didn't want to pay, so we're like, oh, we just found a way to get free kegs, so we'd go jump into backyards and steal from restaurants. We'd get beat up, we'd get in a fist fight, we'd get chased. That was our whole life. We'd skip class to steal kegs. So then that was all we had. I had nothing going on. You know, remember when you were in college, all your parents, what are you going to do? What's the next step? What are you going to be? What are you majoring in? And I had no prospects.
Next step is two more kegs. Exactly. I get two more empty kegs.
Yeah. And so, you know, everybody's like, well, I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be engineering or real estate. And I had nothing cooking. So I said, well, I got nothing else. And out of desperation, I tried stand-up because I was terrified of it, but the desperation kind of kicks in. You go, well, what do I have to lose?
You got to do something.
And I, you know, I have such low self-esteem that stand-up to me was like Bill Cosby, George Carlin. It's like being an astronaut. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you kidding? And, I just tried it, and I bombed, but I had a fun time. I enjoyed it. And I was like, maybe I'll give this a whirl. Then you start finding that world of comedy where you're like, okay, there's a mic on Tuesday at this bar, and there's another thing on Wednesday over here. And you just go, you start meeting everybody, and it becomes like a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I was a drunk, too, so there's a lot of booze involved in
you
comedy.
You fit right into the lifestyle.
Fit right in. It's a bunch of degenerates, a bunch of awkward, anxious, anxiety-riddled weirdos, you know? And you go, hey, this is my group.
These are my people.
I'm home.
Yeah, and eventually me and another guy said, let's go to New York. Let's try this. I've been there. I did film school. Let's go there. And that was it. Wow. So I moved to New York, and it was a horrible transition, but, you know, 12 years later, I'm here.
Can I ask you a question? Like, looking back at it 12 years later, when you realized that you got into it because you were desperate and didn't have another thing to, like, clutch onto, do you think if you had picked something else, you'd be equally as successful at it, or was it just, like, kismet that comedy was the thing you picked?
I think it's a good question. I think I'd be successful in some way of, like, because success in another business is so different. Stand-up, you have to really, like, blood, sweat, and tears and make it on your own and figure out your place and create and adjust. But, like, I don't know. It's such a horrible – I could never do it again. I could never go back to New York and do it all over again. I mean, that was 10 years of – I was a janitor. I was a busboy. I was a furniture mover. I got mugged 3 times the first year. I got bed bugs. My landlord died of AIDS. Just the cold weather.
Oh, I heard that story. If you have not watched, this is not happening.
Oh, yeah.
You please go back and watch it. You'll have a good time on that.
So, yeah, it was horrible. Just and, like, the open mics and the no money, you know, being a Southern guy living in Brooklyn was weird. And so going back, I can never do it again. But I think it had to be comedy. I was just so obsessed with comedy. And so it felt – also, having nothing going on – you know, your back's against the cliff, so you have to keep going.
Right.
Like, you have nothing to follow up. There's no plan B. Plan B is like, maybe I'll be like one of these bellhops at a really nice hotel, you know, or maybe I'll be a UPS guy. That would be, they have benefits. You know, that's how I was thinking. Like,
yeah.
I had no grand plan. And my parents and my brother are all very successful and smart. So I really felt like the loser douche of the family. So I had to make it work.
That's pretty wild. It's pretty wild because, I mean, there's a big leap of faith, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
So I always like to find out what that first time on stage was like for you. Like, where was your first mic that you did?
First mic ever was at Lafayette, Louisiana. We drove like 2 hours. We had beers in the car and we're going nuts. And I barely remember. I was in a blackout, basically, because I was so nervous. I had horrible stage fright. And I remember I had a whole thing on. I had a yeast infection at the time because I was banging this real skank, and
that'll do it.
Yeah,
that's where they come from.
Yeah, they call it jock itch when it's on a guy, but I had a whole mess down there. So I talked about that, and I had a whole Family Feud chunk.
Ah,
yeah. Mm. So those
were those the Richard Karn years?
Yes, I think it was Al Borland. So it all bombed, but I got like a couple chuckles here and there, and I remember the guy was lighting me. And I didn't know what that meant, so I was like, whoa.
Good job. Yeah, good job.
Exactly. So I just kept going, and then he cut the mic, and I was like, well, this mic stinks, huh? Like, so I just kept going, and then eventually they played music, and I looked to the side of the stage, and he's going, get off, you fucking loser. And I was like, oh, shit, sorry. So I totally blew it the first
yeast
time.
Yeast in my ears. I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah. It was terrible.
It's spreading.
Yeah, so that was bad, and then but I was like, that was amazing. I got that rush, and you know, you hang out after, and you talk about this, and so I said, well, what's the next one? And then I remember looking in the phone book for comedy clubs and stuff like that. And
well, you couldn't go right back to that one because he blew the mic. So
yeah,
you got to find another one pretty quick.
I did that one like years later again, but yeah, you're right. I had to find another one. We drive to New Orleans, we drive to here and there, and there's always something. You do a music show or an open for this or whatever, and then. Eventually, you get that stage hungry. Like, I need to get up more. So then we went to New York.
So it's interesting where you've come, how far you've come in 12 years from that to where you are now. Because you, sir, are an amazing joke writer.
Oh, thanks.
As far as, like, punchlines per minute, sir, you are very impressive.
People always tell me, like, you're a joke guy. And I'm like, I don't know how else to get laughs.
Yeah.
What are you doing? Yeah. What are other people? Are you slipping on a pratfall? Are you doing a funny movement? I've tried all that, and none of it works. So I have to have punchline. And I'm scared. I'm 12, 13 years in here. I'm still nervous on stage. Yeah. So if I don't get a laugh every 30 seconds, I'm panicking.
Randomly, I saw somewhere that you were a fan of Groucho Marx.
Oh, yeah. He's a huge influence.
And I got to say, like, once I heard that, I went, oh.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like, it does make sense. I hadn't
it
heard
It does,
that.
Right? Yeah. Like, I mean, you are very fast with punchlines, and you're able to flow in and out of things, like, just like it's the most natural thing in the world.
Oh, thanks.
And it's very impressive, and I could definitely see the influence there.
Yeah, I like the whole, he's actually the smartest guy in the room, even though he's the, you know, the loser in the group. And
exactly.
I kind of relate to that whole thing of, like, just shitting on people and they don't even get it. They don't even notice you're shitting on them.
Right.
And just that quippy kind of, a huge fan of that. Huge. He's so underrated. And, like, you got to realize he's Woody Allen's favorite comic and Bill Cosby. Those guys now are a little different. But that's a pretty good – those are two titans of comedy, and that's – their favorite comic.
Yeah.
That says a lot,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So for those of you who have never explored Groucho, you might want to get on that.
There's a YouTube thing. Somebody made a compilation of, like, his best moments, and it's killer. You got to see it. It holds up still. It's from, you know, the 30s or the 40s or whatever it is. Still holds up.
Yeah. I have to ask you, though, how did you... How far along were you when you started really getting laughs? When you really started realizing you were getting stuff together?
It took years. I mean, I bombed forever. I was a punchline. No, you know, no pun intended. But I probably bombed in New York for like 3 years straight. I'd get a titter here and there, but I was so stand up-y. Like, I was so Seinfeld-y and what's the deal with? Because that's all I knew. I had horrible jokes. One of my jokes was like, why do we say when something's easy, we go, or when something's hard, we go, it's no picnic. No picnic? Picnics are tough. You got to go out there in the sun and get a blanket. The ants show up. No picnic. More like a picnic. And people would be like, ugh. You know, I'm in New York at like the height of like alt comedy. You know,
right.
It's like shit like that. So I'm that guy. I remember one time I walked on stage at an open mic and another comic went, and it crushed me. I got a big laugh, and I remember I was like, ruined.
Right in the dick.
Comedy was way harsher when I started. Like now, I mean, I hate to sound like old man Norman, but like now it's like very huggy-feely and progressive. And you're great, and everyone's great, and we're all equal. And when I started, it was vicious.
Yeah.
It was really mean, and no one would laugh at you. And all the other comics, we all kind of competed. And it made you a better comic, but it was pretty gruesome.
Yeah.
But I remember I was bombing forever. I got just used to bombing. Like, I'm just going to go on and bomb. It was just a normal thing. Like, if I got a laugh, that was weird. That's where I was at.
It surprised you.
Yeah. And I remember I was on stage, and this guy kept heckling
me. I'm trying to finish.
I remember I went on stage at a place called Mo Pitkins. It's no longer there, but it was like a big, hot show, and you had to put your name in a bucket. And if you got on, it was like a big deal. It was an open mic. And I got on, and I was bombing as usual. This is probably 2.5 years into living in New York. Mm-hmm. No money, no nothing, no future. And I'm just miserable, bombing. And this guy keeps heckling me, and I just fucking lose it on him. I go, you fucking piece of... And it was killing. For the first time, I'm killing. And this guy heckling me, I can't remember what I said to him, but I was like, just every day job and the fucking trains and living in Brooklyn and being broke, it all just kind of poured out of me. And that's when I was like, oh, it cracked me of learning how to be myself.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Because I just shed that whole, like, what's the deal with? And I just became myself shitting on this guy. And it was like a epiphany moment. Like, holy shit, this is me. Why was I pretending to be this kind of stand-up-y thing?
Why do you think you were pretending to be such?
I just thought that's how you did it. I was just so dumb. I was just so green. I just thought, like, oh, we're comics. This is how it works. Seinfeld's famous. I'll just do what he did, you know?
Wow.
And that getting heckled, I was so mad at the guy, but it, like, it opened me up to being myself, and that changed everything.
Yeah.
They say, you know, finding your voice, but I've always worded it like it's realizing what your own voice sounds like.
Right.
You know, realizing, like, oh, I can't pull off that stuff. I need to do something else.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, totally. And also the low self-esteem. So I go, I don't want to sound anything like me. I suck.
Yeah.
But you should be doing you. Even if you do suck, just go with that.
Yeah.
It's better to just be you, you know? Because how long, even if you're faking it, how long can you do that?
Yeah.
Like, let's say that catches on. That's why you're like a Larry the Cable Guy or a Dice or basically any character. I would hate to be. I mean, sure, it's a hit, but do you really want to live like that?
Yeah.
You know, you want to be stuck in that? The whole beauty of comedy is the honesty, and you can tell the truth. And, like, what gets a bigger laugh than a joke bombing? Go, well, that joke bombed. That gets a big laugh. Mm-hmm. Because you're just going, oh, yeah, this just happened. This is a real moment. We all felt it.
I feel like one of the biggest lessons that I've ever learned is kind of what you're talking about, is how learning just to be in the moment and acknowledging what's actually happening and not keeping yourself stuck in material.
Totally.
I feel like that's a really interesting way that you kind of came about it.
Yeah.
Of you just shed it. I'm out of it. I'm me. Let's go.
Yeah.
And that was it. And no looking back.
Obviously, material is important. You know, you want to record an album or do TV, you have to have your jokes. But, like, it's got to be on some level, it's got to be in the moment. It's got to be realistic and natural.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that had to change the way you approach joke writing.
Completely. Completely.
Interesting. Yeah.
Louis once saw me, this is, again, years ago, before.
Anderson?
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Cats. he's another Louis. No one will get that except comics. But he saw me and he goes, hey, that's a funny joke, but who cares? And I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, it's a good premise, but who gives a shit? He's like, you should just make it about you somehow. And I was like, ah. He's like, just make it about you and the audience won't be confused. Because they're sitting there going, I get what he's saying, but why is he saying it? And that will take away from the funny.
Oh, wow,
so he just said, make every joke about you somehow. Even if it has nothing to do with, even if it's about Pluto, somehow spin it back into your whatever. And that changed. That was a big joke writing tool.
That's a really interesting thought.
Yeah, I have a joke, an old joke in my first album about Jews must be jealous of gays because Jews are always like, we got to live on, we got to stick with each other and reproduce and make more Jews. And gays are like, we can't even reproduce and we keep popping up, blah, blah, blah. That was the whole premise. And everybody was like, you're not gay or Jewish. What are you talking about? So I made up this whole thing about how I dated a Jewish girl and we were about to get married and her parents wouldn't let me and all that. And then the joke started working.
Wow.
So that's an example of just making it about you somehow.
There's some kind of joke in there about Louis making things about himself.
For those of you watching at home.
Yeah.
For those of you watching at home, comedy is filled with lies. Just so you all know.
Completely.
Just
completely.
Filled what? With lies.
Not me.
Just the way to get
it. As
into
honest
it.
As we all are, we're all a bunch of liars.
Yeah. You still have to construct a joke, you know, structure.
Sure. So just so everybody knows, the text line is open, 585-484-0265. We asked you guys yesterday for some questions for Mark, and you definitely came through for us. So let's start off with a couple of our viewer questions. This one came from Ryan McGinnis. He wants to know, which is your favorite show to appear on? Jim and Sam, Anthony Cumia, or The Bonfire?
Ooh, all different in their own right. Cumia's fun because you're basically just going, fuck it, let's just go nuts here, let's just ruin everything, let's burn it all down,
right.
You know, let's say offensive shit and be horrible. But Bonfire is almost challenging because those two guys are so funny and quick, Big J and Dan Soder.
Yeah.
And you have to, like, it's like an exercise and just, it's like double dutch where that fucking rope is swinging and you gotta just jump in at the right time and you don't want the rope to hit you and you ruin the whole thing. It's a house of cards.
Right.
So that one is really fun and it's all about being funny, which I like. But Jim and Sam I like because it's conversational.
Sure.
You know, you can just go off and go back and then Jim says something and then you take it a certain way and then Sam kind of mediates. So they're all great in their own ways, but I think I like
Opie's podcast the best.
Yeah, I think I like Jim and Sam the most because you can be the funny one.
Gotcha.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, not that Jim's fucking amazing and quick, but
that Sam really needs to pick it up.
Yeah.
I gotcha. just kidding. So the answer is Jim and Sam, Ryan. Next question came from Reese Green. What's the coolest place you've ever done stand-up comedy or the most unique location you've ever done a show at?
Oh, boy. Well, the weird thing is the unique spots are always the worst.
Exactly. You know? It's, yeah, exactly.
Definitely. It's always somebody like, we're going to do a show in a laundromat. How cool is that? And you're like, this is horrible. There's people just trying to live their lives and fold their unmentionables, and I'm talking about fucking, you know, how about smart cars, huh? And they're like, well, I'm just trying to get out of here, you
Jews
fucking
always
asshole.
Want to reproduce.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So unique places suck. Stop trying to be different and put your show in a fucking old folks home or whatever you're doing. But yeah, geez, where haven't I done a show? I did a show like in the middle of a restaurant where you have to spin and talk to all the tables and they're just trying to eat. I've done shows everywhere. Most unique though, I always blank on these because I don't have anything prepared. Done a million shows. Did a show at an airport. That was hell.
That does sound like hell.
That the second you said that, I kind of sat up a second, like, oh no.
Oh yeah.
Was it like an airport bar or
airport bar? Yeah.
Or was it just like a gate 13?
No.
I was gonna say Terminal C.
I was on the flight 9/11. No, it was at I've done a show. One place that shows work is fire halls. You ever done a fire hall show?
I love fire hall gigs.
Those are great.
Everybody's just so goddamn happy that they have something to do.
Yes, and you can't offend a cop or a fireman because they see people dying and shit. Yeah. So words don't bother them.
Yeah,
and that's relief.
I love fire hall gigs.
I love them. Every time I've ever gotten one, I'm like, yes. I've had one hell gig at a fire department, and that's it.
Yeah.
There was two firemen left by the time the thing started.
Yeah.
Because it was 9,000 degrees, and there was no air conditioning in the hall.
Oh, jeez.
And then they were like, yeah, we still need you to do a half hour. And there was just like two guys and a big giant fan. It was just the worst day of my life.
And yelling over a fan to two guys.
All right. I did a fire gig in Long Island, and the alarm went off. True story. And they all had to run out. And I was like, well, this is great. I'm done. You know, like, I still get paid. And they're just going to stop a fire.
They didn't make you wait, like, hold that thought?
No. They had to go save lives. And I was like, great. And I just hit, like, the chafing dish area.
Nice. Part of me would have been tempted to try to throw one of those jackets on and just see if I could have snuck along. Just hung on the back of the truck.
Right.
Okay, so the answer probably is an airport, Reese.
Yeah.
This one came from Chuck Hazlett. He wants to know, Mark, if you were a meme, what meme would you be?
Ooh. Well, a lot of memes have been stolen from me.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer.
Which is why I love this question, because I want to talk to you about that.
Yeah, please. I, this one joke has been stolen 8 zillion times, and it keeps getting stolen. And what's nice is sometimes a fan will just tag you, and you're like, all right, somebody knows. It's all you want is a little acknowledgement.
Which one is it?
It's I wouldn't mind having a gay son. Having a gay son's like finding a French fry in your onion rings. You're like, well, it's not what I expected, but I like these too. It's just a quick one-liner gay joke, and it gets ripped off a ton. I get like two a day on Instagram, like, hey, somebody stole this again. It was the front page of Reddit last week. No credit. And then I have another one where I say, prude girls are like mom and pop shops. They're more expensive and they close early. And sluts are like Walmart. You know, they're open at 4 in the morning. And every time you're inside one, you go, I'm glad these are around. Yeah. Old joke. But again, that gets stolen all the time and no credit.
So, like, when you see that, does it, I'm sure, obviously it bothers you because, like, damn it, I wrote it, no credit.
Yeah.
But does it make you want to just scrap the joke? Like obviously, I mean, you said they're older jokes. You probably don't do them much anymore. But at that point, it's pretty much useless to you.
Yeah.
Even though it's your own intellectual property.
That's a good point. Yeah. I mean, it's old jokes I don't do anymore. So I go, what the hell? But it's also slightly flattering that somebody put this joke up and all these thousands of people are going, this is great, so funny, smiley face. So you're like, hey, you kind of feel like the faceless hero.
Gene Perrette. You're sitting in the sidelines watching Carson get the laughs.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like when Batman swoops in and saves somebody and just leaves.
All they see is a swoosh.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm the swoosh. So there you go. That it's kind of flattering. And you get the one guy who goes, Mark, somebody stole your bit. And you go, all right, at least somebody knows.
And that's got to make you feel good, too.
That's nice, yeah.
Yeah. But overall, like a dick kick? Like a little bit of a dick kick?
Yeah. Okay. Especially when you can't get a buck or you can't figure anything out in this biz and you're trying to get a show or whatever. You're trying to get something to go viral and take off. And then something does. And you're like, but my name's not on it. So that part sucks.
Yeah.
All we're trying to do is get some kind of exposure, and now it's happening with my art or whatever, but it doesn't count.
I'm going to digress here, and I'm going to get back to the questions here, but I'm glad you brought that up. I heard you talking, and you made a really interesting point about all the late-night shows that you've done, and basically how, you know, it's been able – obviously, you get yourself out there, and late-night isn't necessarily the behemoth and kingmaker that it used to be in the business. But the positive for doing Conan seven times, The Tonight Show – Stephen Colbert, doing all these shows just gives you great film of yourself that you can use to promote. Yeah.
Completely.
And I've never heard anybody actually say that, and I thought that was a really brilliant way of looking at it because it is so different, but it is still an amazing tool to get yourself over with.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. I can't get a Netflix special. I've tried. I've tried to get this and that. Schumer was nice enough to give me an hour. But I wouldn't have gotten one without her. I even tried to get one. They were like, no, thank you. She put her name on it. They were like, we'll do it. And you're like, ah, geez, all right. I'm the same guy, you know. But I get it. They're just trying to get ratings. It's all a business. So I figure everybody always makes fun of me. Like, why are you doing these late nights? They don't do a thing. They don't move the needle. And I go, what are you kidding? I'm in a suit on HD film on TV. You know, let's not pretend TV is not fun.
Sure.
And an audience that's way hotter than some audience at a comedy club, and they're applauding on every setup and giving you, you know, giving it up, and it looks great, and it's all over YouTube, and they're in 5-minute chunks, and it's pristine material. Like, these are worked out 5 minutes. You're not going to go on Fallon and just throw something together.
It's not like filming, slapping a camera up on an open mic.
Yes, yes. And now it's all on YouTube, and people see it, and it gives it that like seal of approval. Like, oh, this is on TV. This is on Fallon. This is on Colbert. And it's a really worked out, tight 5 minutes with a good opening, a good big closer. And then you watch one, and you get in that rabbit hole. So it's almost like I have 12 late nights. So what's that? 55 minutes, or is that an hour?
Roughly an hour.
Yeah, roughly an hour. So that's basically a special.
Yeah.
Of jokes that are tried and true. It's not like new shit. You know, sometimes you watch a special, it's a bit of a lull. You know, we've all seen that. Like, oh, this is a long hour here. The middle part's not great. That part didn't really hit. But this is all punchy stuff. You know? It has to be if it's going to be on late night.
Yeah.
It's very, I mean, 12 late night appearances is very impressive.
Oh,
is
thanks.
That, like, I mean...
People make fun of me. Why are you doing that? I'm like, why not? It's fun for me as well. Like, I'm not just doing this for you. It's fun for me to go on 30 Rock in a suit and go on.
I get the vibe that you feel like those are just, like, playoff appearances.
Right,
like, that's the vibe I'm getting from you. Like, I feel like you don't feel like getting on the Tonight Show is the Super Bowl. What's the Super Bowl to you?
Super Bowl. That's a good question.
No, that's a good question.
I guess a Netflix special is the Super Bowl. But, again, I feel, I don't know, the hours... Like, I love Anthony Jeselnik, and I watched his special, and it's great, and he's brilliant and the whole thing, but, like, an hour still feels long. I'm watching it going, all right, it's a long hour. Here we go. Come on. I don't know if the hour is the thing now. It almost feels too – we're ADD'd out, you know, and one joke after another. Like, Bill Burr, obviously, I could watch 5 years of, but,
there's
like,
transcendent talent.
It's
like it's one of those things where – the guy's on a different level, on a different planet. And if you're on that level, hour away, two hour away, go to town.
Yeah, I think I rarely sit and watch a special on TV, like the whole thing.
Through. Totally.
I'll watch the whole thing, but not in one sitting usually. Yeah.
Not in one sitting.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't want to say who or give away his idea, but I'll just do it anyway. This one guy I know said, I want to do 20 minutes a year. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, well, Louis did the hour a year, and everybody, you know, went nuts, and it changed the game. But nobody wants to watch an hour. Also, every time you watch these yearly hours, you go, God, if that had 6 more months or another year on it, it would be so much better. But 20 minutes, you can really perfect in a year. And when they come see you based off the 20 minutes, you'll have new shit.
Yeah.
Because they only gave them 20. And I was like, that's a brilliant idea. So if I was had some juice, I would do that.
Can I guess, like, initials of who said that?
Yeah.
A.S.?
No.
Okay. All right.
A.S. I don't know who that could be.
Yeah, you do.
Do I?
I was thinking it was Andrew Schultz. It sounds like an Andrew Schultz kind of thing.
Oh, that does sound like a thing he would do, but no, it's not him.
Okay. No problem.
But good guess.
But no, that's very interesting. That really is, it's out of the box and brilliant. It's pretty slick.
Yeah, yeah, it's not bad. So now everybody will steal that.
Yeah. I'm stealing 20 minutes.
But it's like memes are the most popular thing ever. Everybody loves a meme. And what is that? A photo or a 1 minute
with
clip?
With a sentence.
With a sentence. That's the most popular thing. And we're trying to put an hour together? I don't know. It just feels like we're going towards shareable, quick bites of comedy.
And that's why, you know, 12 late nights doesn't hurt.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't hurt.
And everybody makes fun of me, but fuck it.
I will not make fun of you for that.
Thanks.
Another question. Sarah Shipley wants to know. She said, this is long bit of a question.
Mark
just came off of a bigger national tour with Bert Kreischer.
Yeah.
That was the Body Shots tour.
That's right.
Okay.
All over Europe.
Now, what's it like to travel with a friend on such an exciting tour? It looked like one big old college party with some comedy sprinkled in. What are the biggest differences between touring the U.S. and doing international gigs? And do you prefer one or the other? That was a lot.
That's a lot, but good question, Sarah?
Sarah,
yeah. First of all, that tour was insane. It was 14 days, 14 cities with the machine. Bert Kreischer is like the real deal. I don't know how he does it. He's got the Mickey Mantle gene. This guy will drink in the morning, then he'll go work out, then he'll drink at lunch, and then he'll drink at the shows, and then we'll go out at night and drink all night, and then go to bed, and he does it again the next day. Now, I'm 12, 13 years younger than him, and I'm a booze bag, and I was struggling. I mean, you want to take a day off every now and then. This is every day. For 14 days with flights, with fucking bus rides, with car rides, with the, you know, two shows a night. It was fucking hard. When you're drunk, everything's great, but then you wake up and you want to kill yourself and you got to fly from Copenhagen to Dublin, you know, like between you and me, there was a couple times where I was pouring out shots, you know,
you were
on the fly.
What? You were Ric Flair in it.
Yeah.
That's what he used to do. He used to pretend to be drinking, and he would throw, like, every other drink in a plant.
Exactly. I would have to do it just to keep up. And, like, also, you want to perform well, so you don't want to be too shithoused on stage, and you want to kill, and you don't want to ruin the show by slurring words or repeating a joke. So he truly is impressive. Like, the fact that he can run marathons, he's in better, like, he's a big guy, but he's so athletic. Like, he never gets tired.
He runs marathons? How did I not know that?
Yeah, he did Sober October where he ran marathon. He does spin classes. He does hot yoga. I mean, the guy is a specimen. He's a phenom.
Right.
He doesn't really eat a lot either. He just, it's all beer gut. Like, he could put him back. He's like Stone Cold Steve Austin. You just throw him a beer, he chugs it, and he does whatever he's got to do. He works out drunk. Who does that? I mean, the guy is...
Seems unsafe. He's going to lose a finger.
I don't know how long he's going to last, to be honest. I want him around, but he's pushing it, man. He's burning the candle. And he would always say, like he'd be drunk. We'd have an hour flight. He'd have three beers on the flight. And I'd be like, dude, don't you want to take a break? And he'd be like, I'll just borrow a little from tomorrow. He would always say, I'm borrowing from tomorrow. I'm like, well, tomorrow we'll be drinking too. So,
you don't want to borrow too much from tomorrow. It's a pretty good rule of thumb.
Right. Tomorrow, before you know it, you'll be 61 and you'll be dead because there's no more tomorrow. So you used them all. So I hate to talk like that, but I love the guy. But he's so funny, and I feel like people give Bert shit because he's like the shirtless guy and he's the machine. But man, that guy, he's a comedy glossary. He knows every joke. He helped me punch up my act. I worked with his act a lot. Like, he has great taste in comedy. He hates all the right people.
That is how you have good taste in comedy. You gotta hate the right people.
Yeah, I mean, he's brilliant.
It's not who you like, it's who you hate them.
Yes. Yeah. But again, these people have kids and a mortgage, and he's trying to make some money, and you know, we're all getting older. So it was like a PhD in marketing. Once I got back to New York, I learned so much more about how to get some exposure. He's like, you're doing that wrong. You should do this. And my numbers went way up, and they have been going up because of what he taught me. So L.A. is kicking New York's ass podcast-wise. And Bert had the best line. He goes, you guys all worship Attell in New York, which we do. We all love Attell.
Yeah.
And in L.A., we all worship Rogan. And look who's more successful. Attell's struggling to sell out the Funny Bone, and he's just working on the new tag. Whereas Rogan is putting out whatever special he wants and making zillions.
And selling you brain pills.
Yeah, selling you brain pills, making zillions on a podcast, and selling out an arena.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, shit, you're right. And he's like, I'm not saying you got to become Rogan, but maybe get a taste of that. Maybe just do 90-10 of that kind of marketing.
Start selling some dick pills or something.
Something.
Yeah.
So, but to answer a question, I just want to say Europe is way better audiences than here.
Tell me about that. I'm fascinated.
Well, we've gone all, we're all PC. We're all jerking each other off about being offended, and I'm woke, and I'm gay, and I'm a douche, whatever. But, like, over there, they understand the joke. It's like a piece.
Yeah, they definitely get that this isn't meant to be serious.
I have school shooting jokes. I have pedophilia jokes. And those were hard jokes to construct because, obviously, you're tap dancing on thin ice there.
Especially in society today in America.
So they realize, like, oh, he's going for it, and he pulled it off. Well done. Well done.
It's like watching gymnastics.
Yes, completely. He stuck the landing, and they applaud, and they laugh, and they realize that was impressive. They don't go, that was offensive. They go, that was impressive. They realize that the steps it took to get there, and you still nailed it. So they, like, applaud. So you feel like you're, like, an artist up there. Like, oh, wow, they get it. I'm not just trying to be a douche and offend you. I'm trying to write a piece of comedy.
And I think they're aware enough of what's going on in our country right now that they're even more surprised than an American would say that.
Completely.
They're shocked, like, oh my God, an American said that?
Completely, yes.
We used to be the assholes. Now everybody thinks we're the super overly nice and
As long
as you don't have a southern accent, they assume you're a super nice person.
Yeah, and I mean, they're smarter than us, they're better than us in a lot of ways, but we got them on comedy. Americans are better at comedy than. You can blow British people all day, but come on, they suck. You know, I know they think they're scholarly and witty and all that, but we're not laughing. We need to laugh, you cunts. So, you know, you can jerk yourself off all day with how much you know, but you got to have a chuckle. So we got them on comedy, and they know that, I think, and they come out and they go, wow, this was great, because Europeans, they do a thing where they do an hour every year, and that's impressive, but anybody can do an hour every year if it's not funny. You know, I can just talk for an hour. I'm doing it right now. I'm not funny. You know, but
you'd,
like,
be surprised. There's thousands of people who do that in America every year, too.
That's true.
That nobody's
ever
heard of.
And no one's heard of them.
Or will.
Yes. And they go, well, I was beaten. Let me do my hour on getting beaten by my dad. And you're like, all right, but is it funny? I'd rather 2 minutes on the beating thing and just give me the one punchline. And we'll skip the 58 minutes. You know, I don't need to feel good at the end. I'm not Nanette. All right, just give me the fucking jokes.
This isn't a TED Talk.
Yes, give me the yucks.
Do you feel like too many people are kind of confusing stand-up comedy and, what am I looking for? Like almost self-help seminars, it feels like.
Oh, completely, because self-help is easy. It's all narcissism and entitlement. I struggled. I grew up poor. I have anxiety. I'm autistic. Let me tell you about it. All right, I get it, but jokes are hard. Jokes are hard to write. It's really hard to write a joke that works and that's original. And I think we're doing this whole thing where we're confusing moral superiority and, you know, my struggle and my pain. We're substituting that for good jokes. That's all it comes down to. And I sound like a cunt, and everybody's going to call me an alt-right lunatic, which is so funny.
You know,
that's
I don't think
the
there's anything
now.
Alt-righty about that.
Of course
I
there's
think
not, but that's the go-to, because alt-right is a shutdown. Being racist is a shutdown. That's how you win in that argument, you know?
Yeah, but I watched you last night, like, the way that you approach it on stage, though. I think in I mean this in the nicest way, you're non-threatening, too. Like, your persona
well.
Is not, you know?
Yeah.
And you don't come across in a tone that seems like you're furious about it. You talk about the PC culture, but it doesn't seem like you're angry about it.
Right.
It just sounds like you're just talking about it.
Yeah. Are you angry about it?
Making jokes about it.
I'm not angry about it, but I'm frustrated because it belittles how hard comedy is.
It comes across in a tone of concern. That's what I was looking for. You seem concerned about it. You don't seem like furious and shouting they're making the frogs gay and stuff.
That's my thing, is I'm a liberal cuck fag douche. I'm a Democrat homo, you know, like I think I'm all about, you know, diversity and helping people and making things right and changing stuff and progress. But this is comedy, folks. Let's not mix it up.
Yeah.
Let's not ruin the water. Go help people. Go do whatever you got to do. Go save the whales and blow your aunt or whatever you're doing. But, like, let's keep the stage funny. It's called a comedy club. That's the name on the wall, comedy club. And I get it that we've kind of done this thing where we construed it to where it's like Because, you know, Richard Pryor, you know, one of the best ever, is like, hey, I blew a guy for crack. I was molested. My mom was a prostitute. I saw people fuck my mom in front of me. But he made it funny, and that's why. Funny, yeah. Yeah, that's what's incredibly hard. So it bums me out when somebody just does the my mom's a crackhead part, and you go, all right. And then they go, well, what do you mean, all right? That wasn't easy. I go, I get that wasn't easy, but comedy's also not easy. And just because I said a gay joke and you got offended by it, that doesn't mean what I'm doing is bad either. And what I'm doing is what you're supposed to be doing is making it funny.
And to a room full of comics, you're trying to tell a story like the something horrible thing. Like you said earlier, comics are all a bunch of fucked up people.
Yeah.
So if you go up on stage and tell some terrible story about your mom being a crackhead, a bunch of comics are going to go, and?
And?
Yeah.
And that's fine to do, but you can't expect to get, because a lot of people go like, but I'm this, and I'm a whatever, and I struggle, and you're that, and you don't get it. And you're like, I don't care what you are. The whole point is comedy. It'd be like saying, hey, you gotta let me on this basketball team. My mom is trans, and it's hard to grow up that way. And you're like, yeah, but can you shoot a three? And they go, no, but my mom is trans. And you're like, yeah, but we need to make a basket. We need the points. That's all it is. It has nothing to do with your struggle or what you're going through, but people have skewed it. And somehow the water has gotten muddied with this, like,
well,
comedy mixed with tragedy. It's still got to have a punchline.
I feel like comedy is always best when it's through a true prism of, like you said earlier, your personality, who you are. But again, the point is, you have to put comedy through that prism.
Yes.
If there's no comedy coming through it, and it's just we're listening to you talk about you.
Right.
We're all done. It's like it's over with. And if you expect an applause for that or you expect a laugh from that,
you are
the problem.
Yes.
Not the audience.
And I'm not saying you're a bad person.
Not at
or
all.
We don't like you or I'm better than you or anything. It's just that it's got to be funny. It's got to be funny when I do it. It's got to be funny when you do it. It's actually quite even. It's a very even playing field.
I'll say that I don't like them.
All right. Well, there you go. Well, they tend to be very disturbed people usually. Like the people who come at me like, this was a problem, and that's problematic. And I'm like, what's up with you? Something's going on with you first. Let's deal with that, and then we'll come to me. I just want you to be funny. I don't care what you are. I have zero qualms, but I'm a black woman. I don't care. That doesn't mean anything to me. I'm just treating you like a person. I don't care if you're a white man or a black woman or an Asian serial killer, whatever it is. It's got to be humorous. That's right. All. Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a point to make, and you could be anything in the world and be hysterical.
Yes!
And you could be anything in the world and not be funny.
Exactly. Like this whole, like, my friend's a Puerto Rican comic, and he did this comedy for diversity thing, and they were like, oh, you're Puerto Rican, that's great, we need a Puerto Rican. And he just walked. He was like, fuck this. I want to be funny. I don't want to be the Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
And I'm like, good for you. That's what you should be doing. It should be about funny.
Who books it?
When I was starting out in comedy, there would be always be like weirdos at the open mic. Like you get the heroin addict guy off the street, you get the hobo off the street.
We got one of those. His name's Todd.
There you go. You get the old grandma who's like kind of losing
it. He's doing a guest spot tonight.
Is he?
Oh, is it really?
Ah, jeez. Nobody ran that.
Tell him hi for me.
But I'm saying that was like the weird, like, oh, here we got one of these now. And now comedy is, hey, I watched my dad shoot my mom when I was 7. And you're like, oh, you're just the new heroin addict. You know what I mean? Like, you're just the guy who's just using this to have attention, not about the actual art of comedy, you know?
Attention addicts instead of heroin addicts.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all attention at the end of the day.
Well, yeah, absolutely right. You just took the words out of my mouth. It is all about attention by the end of the day.
And then to attack other comics, that's a whole other bag of hammers we can get into later, but that's crazy to me. Sorry.
Comics love a good mob, don't they?
Oh, yeah, totally. Well, mob means we're all unfunny, so we'll stick together. If we're all unfunny and stick together, we have some juice.
Yeah, but you can get 15 of them together, they still can't come up with a joke.
Yeah, I know, but notice no one who's doing well is in these mobs, you know? Like, I'm friends with Michelle Wolf. She's a hilarious comic. She sits around going, what? Just go right. What are you talking about? Why are you on Facebook complaining about the state of comedy and how you can't get booked? Go get booked. Go write. Where's your act? Let me see the act. Well, I'm too busy fighting the man to work on the act. Well, then you suck. Then you're in the wrong world. It should be about the, funny used to be number one on the list. Now funny's like 14th.
And that's a sad reality.
Of course.
The fact of the matter is, ladies and gentlemen, the only thing that matters in the comedy business is if you could get laughs, number one.
Yeah.
If the audience laughs.
Right.
That's what bookers listen to. Bookers barely listen to your jokes. They listen to laughs.
Yeah, that's why Hack is winning, you know, because they just go, oh, he's killing. Put him on. But yeah, it's so true. It's actually the most diverse, open-minded equality you can be. Laughter. Yeah. Doesn't matter what vehicle or vessel it's coming from. It's just laughter. That's it.
Wow. That's really well said.
But it's all so simple. I'm not even a smart guy. Why can I see this? These are educated people, these nuts who come out and complain.
I don't know, but I think I would like to subscribe to your newsletter. I like the way you think. Thank you so much for coming in.
I don't want to
keep you all day. I know you got some other stuff to do, but it really was a pleasure having you on. I hope to have you on again.
Yeah, sure.
You can check out Mark's podcast, Tuesdays with Stories.
Yes.
You could check out his one-hour special. You could see him here this weekend for four more shows. Tonight there's two. Tomorrow there's two. Brian's going to be there. I'm sorry for that, but come see Mark.
Brian killed it last night.
That's what I heard. The crowd was completely dead by the time he left the stage.
Can you save that clip of Mark Norman saying that I killed it for later?
I'm actually going to edit it out. We're going to be right back with Stand Up News with Ross. Stay tuned, everybody. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Comedy at the Carlson Cast. I want to say thanks to our great friends. How about Chef Joe over at Sapori Cafe and Catering? They're located inside of the Powers Building Atrium downtown and have the best lunch specials you're going to find in Rochester. And to top it off, they could cater your very own special event. Visit at Sapori Rochester on Instagram and find them on Facebook for more information. You could also check out our good friends over at Three Heads Brewing. Jeff and the boys over there make the finest beers you're going to find this side of the Genesee River. And they also have an amazing, amazing brewery with live music just about every night of the week. Check out threeheadsbrewing.com for more information there. And we also want to say thanks to our friends at Iron Smoke Whiskey. Always remember to drink responsibly, but they make delicious stuff. They make Rattlesnake Rosie's Apple Pie Whiskey and a traditional Applewood Smoked Whiskey. Visit ironsmokewhiskey.com or you can visit their tasting room on Parse Avenue in Fairport. So, thanks, sponsors. Now it's time for a show. Thank you for being awesome and watching another episode of the Carlson Cast. Don't forget we're streaming live on Facebook and YouTube every Friday morning. You could also follow us on social media on Twitter and Instagram at CarlsonCast. You can listen anytime on iTunes, Google Play, and we're now available on Spotify. You should also check out an amazing app called Laughable. And on the Laughable app, you can connect to your favorite comedians in a way you never thought you could before. Download it in the App Store and visit carlsoncast.com for information on more shows. And don't be a jerk. Rate and review. Hey, everybody. We are back. And I got to tell you something. This is my favorite segment because it's the one we get to do right before we leave. So without any further ado, Ross Johnson on Stand Up News, everybody.
Good morning, everybody. Hello. Thank you.
Bye, everybody. It's Vinny and Brian.
Thank you for the slow clap, two people applause.
That's all you're worth. Read the news.
The best I've ever done.
Take what you can get.
So we don't do a lot of international political news here on the Carlson Cast News, of course, but
because we are a comedy club in Rochester, New York, doing a podcast.
Correct.
Okay.
So I've got the election returns. Ukraine. This was really interesting. So recently, Ukraine elected a new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, who is a up until approximately a few weeks ago when he got elected president, stand-up comedian and a comedian. So this is a potential career goal for anyone.
Was it a bringer election?
That was actually a good joke. You're redeemed.
Yeah. Yeah.
He brought five friends. Get on the ballot.
He brought five friends.
They each had to buy two drinks.
He was a comedian. He was a stand-up comedian. He was a comedy actor. So this is really interesting. So he did have a law degree, but he was the star of this show called Servant of the People.
You are the worst.
No, no, that's the actual name of the show.
That's Ukrainian.
Yeah.
This is very authentic. So the show is called Servant of the People. He was on this show for a while, and it was sort of a political comedy show where he played, like, the leader of Ukraine or something,
mm-hmm.
And then decided to run for president of Ukraine under the auspices of his new party called Servant of the People. Which he created and won with 73% of the vote.
So, okay, that's great.
You know.
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. We had a guy who also had a television show ride that into the White House.
That hasn't worked out well for other countries that have tried.
And I feel like maybe...
I'm not plotting this necessarily.
Like,
I just reported.
If you had told me
this
story 5 years ago, sure. I would have been like, yeah, comedian got it. Now I'm going... This is scary. This is frightening me.
It's a little scary, especially when somebody gets 73% of the vote running as their TV character. Yeah, that's a little alarming.
Yeah, I'm writing in Selena Meyer.
I was going to say, I might vote Selena Meyer. Right.
Now, yeah. Right. Well, I beat you to the joke, so it's mine.
So there you go. Okay, so another semi-political news. So Canadian comedians, this is another potential thing that we want to keep an eye on. Canadian comedians are heading to the capital to lobby for... their rights. There's a newly formed, essentially a union, the Canadian Association of Stand-Up Comedians.
I've heard a little bit about this. I'm glad you did this story. Keep going.
Yeah, so they're heading up to Parliament, I believe, next week to campaign for rights and recognition. Basically, they've got a whole platform of stuff, but what it boils down to is they're looking for, and I think this is probably true in the United States too, there are a lot of arts programs for... Like if you're a ballet company or if you're a whatever, you know, if you're a woodwind ensemble,
sure.
They're looking for similar sorts of.
they want grants. They want to have stand up grants and endowments.
I'm referring to things that I've done. That's all I know how to do.
You play water glasses.
They're meeting with representatives of the government. They're looking for they're dealing with issues of. Labor. They're looking for, you know, potential arts grants. Another thing they're looking into, they're asking the government to look into is apparently when Canadian comedians in official capacities do work in America, they get charged big fees that American comedians don't get charged when they go to Canada. So they're
Let's keep it that way. That I'm fine with. I'm fine with the status quo on that
way. Because they're unquestionably funnier than us, and we'd rather they stay on their side of the wall.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's not like Canadian comedians have no, you know, have no platform in America. So
did you hear that, Scott Thompson? You stay up there.
So they're asking the government to look into all these issues. So this is a newly formed union that's coming together, and they're hoping to do more with it. And I thought it was interesting.
You know, Canada has some very strict laws in regards to what you can and can't say on stage. There's been lawsuits. Over jokes. There's been people arrested over jokes in Canada. So I think that it's interesting that the comedians found a constructive way to, speak up for themselves to the government. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. And good story. I appreciate you doing that
one.
Yeah,
I hadn't heard about that.
You got it, man. I'll try to keep us posted on that if I remember to do so. So...
you'll forget and you'll find a story about Cat Williams and you'll just giggle to yourself and never follow up.
It's so funny, though. Did you guys ever watch In Between Two Ferns, the Jack Galifianakis?
Yeah, yes, of course.
So they're making a movie, apparently. So this is a quick one. But this is, you know, he's not done new ones for a while, I don't believe. But Funny or Die and Netflix are teaming up. So September 20th. There's going to be a Between Two Ferns movie, the plot of which is Will Ferrell discovers Galifianakis' public access TV show, Between Two Ferns, uploads it to Funny or Die, turns the host into a laughingstock. In order to rehab his reputation, Galifianakis decides to take Between Two Ferns on the road to conduct a series of high-profile celebrity interviews. And they have not announced the guest list for that movie yet,
but
that's being kept under wraps for the time being. But
I'd prefer to see a prequel. Like, basically, like, the germination of the two ferns kind of a thing.
Like, it starts out in their seeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, just, like, just like 2 hours of time-lapse footage of ferns growing.
You could do that on PBS.
And sure.
Meryl Streep is playing one of the ferns.
Oh, my God.
She plays the fern's mother.
Yeah.
That keeps them firm and grounded.
She can play anything. She could play a fern.
Anything. She can play a fern.
Funny thing.
She didn't move for 2 hours. Funny thing. It was amazing. Yeah. She got an Oscar.
Meryl Streep has been playing Zach Galifianakis this whole time.
What?
I believe it.
Yep.
What?
She's actually Ross. All right, what else you got?
Scrubs off the makeup.
There's one story I can't wait for you to get to. So keep going.
So this is a quick one, so don't get too excited. But this is an update on not just Artie Lang, but on Artie Lang's nose specifically. So we talked. I think it was last.
What nose?
Yeah. So the one on the one side is like, because I've only seen face front pictures, but this mugshot where you can see that he has like no nose. And this is clearly, I don't know if he's said specifically, but this is pretty clearly the result of drug use. And
he got punched in the nose.
Well, he got punched in the nose, but I think he had a, I think his nose was weakened to begin with.
Sure, but like the punch is what did it, supposedly. Like literally someone popped him in the nose and now it's flat.
I thought they only went flat like that in Looney Tunes. I didn't know that happened to real people.
So the quick update on this, of course, he was arrested last week. We learned, we were sad to hear. We hope he's doing okay. But there's a plastic surgeon from a reality TV show called Botched, which is about...
Okay, mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you something. That show... Yep.
Okay, I have not seen
sucks
the show.
Me in okay. all the time. Freak show after freak show after freak show. Go parade in there going, fix it. It's worth watching. That's all I'm going to say.
Do they do it for free?
No, hell no. They got an office at Beverly Hills. What are you, for real?
I'm on the show, though. If I'm on the show, can I get my man boobs taken care of is my question. That's what I'm
No, like you would have had to have gone and...
Someone would have had to add them.
Somebody would have had to have tried to fix them first.
Yeah.
Like my mom?
Yes. Not genetics, no. Say you had Brian perform surgery on you in his garage... And you're like, so it didn't go well, and here's what happened. Like, they come in and they just, it's a crazy show. So what do they say? What are they going to do to fix him?
So this is
Dr. Dubrow, I think his name is.
This is very off
the
cuff. Well, this is Paul Nassif.
Oh, the other one, okay.
Yep, so so what Artie has apparently is called a saddle nose deformity, the result of a collapsed septum.
You could ride his nose down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Dr. Nassif says if Artie Lang can get himself permanently clean, which, you know, God bless. He would be willing to fix it. So that's the.
He thinks he could fix it?
He thinks he can fix it. He would be, says he'd be willing and able to fix it. So I'm sure he'd be willing to, because that would be a good
okay,
for
so
your show. But
if I'm Artie Lang, I'm thinking, listen, Doc, if you could fix it, I can find somebody else to fix it. Then is it going to put conditions on me?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm sure Artie Lang still got, I mean, I would think he's still got plenty of money, right?
I don't think he does.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I think he's having some trouble. I mean, I feel bad for that guy. He's really... He had a rough go of it growing up, and, man, I hate to see, like, him heading towards...
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those people where you don't feel like he's a bad guy. He's just, you know, has not been able to quite get his life in order, you know?
Yeah. So We keep Cam around, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, what else you got?
Okay, so... last story, the Punchline Comedy Club in San Francisco. I don't know if you're familiar with this. This is another one of these long time, sort of legendary places. So this is a place where Dave Chappelle had done, and has continued to do a lot of, did some work early in his career there and has continued to use it as a place to try out new material and things like that. Apparently they're closing down. The mortgage holder, Morgan Stanley, has refused to renew their lease for reasons that were sort of unclear, but assuming there's, you know, I'm assuming it has
probably somebody will pay them more.
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody will pay them more. So they had announced that the place was going to close down. As far as we know, it still is. But Dave Chappelle, W. Kamau Bell, some other people have gotten gone and created a give up today. There's a hashtag Save the Punchline. They did a rally at City Hall in San Francisco to try to raise awareness and raise money and raise interest in keeping the Punchline open. It was opened in 1978 by restaurateur Jeffrey Pollock, and I guess it's been a pretty common and popular place ever since. So trying to save it. No word on whether they've been successful, but they're doing their best.
I have a question.
Yeah.
After watching you literally just stall out like a car from the 70s,
sure.
What exactly is written on that paper? What do you even have on that paper? Because you're looking at it and just freaking out. What is going on?
You know what my problem is?
Turn it around and show it to me.
So today my problem is I've got way too much information, so I'm trying to filter through this in the last second. It's just not working. So that's my problem.
Maybe try a larger font.
Larger font would be good.
Larger font.
Fewer words.
Smaller words.
Yeah.
3 to 4 words would be fine.
And maybe, I don't know.
No more than 2 syllables.
I'm just sleepy, you know? It's all right. I can be sleepy once in a while, okay?
Can you see, I caught it. I just caught it from you.
Yeah.
I can't do any more of the show. That's it. That's this week's Carlson Cast. That's it. We're out of here, baby.
We're all going to bed.
We're all going to lunch at Sapori.
Little Spoon.
We'll be...
All right.
Now I'm uncomfortable. Now I'm uncomfortable. I said we're going to lunch, and he's already like making bedroom arrangements for people. Just freaking, what did that do to a show? Thanks, Mark Norman, for coming in. Make sure you keep an eye out for him. He's going to be doing big things. We are going to be back next week with Dan Soder. So stick around. We'll see you next time. Later, Marks.